Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:36 p.m. on Wednesday, February 18th, 2026. And present today, we've got Representative Moore, Representative Bynum, Representative Co-Chair Josephson, Representative Jimmy, Representative Galvin, and myself, Co-Chair Foster, and Representative Allard. And before we start, if folks could please mute their cell phones. We also have with us Representative Stapp. And we have two items on the agenda today. The first one is public testimony on House Bill 280. That is the highly digitized business bill. And then we're going to set that bill aside after we do public testimony. After that, we will hear a presentation from the Department of Health regarding the operating budget for the Department of Health. And so at this time, I am going to go ahead and open public testimony for House Bill 280, a highly digitized business bill. And if folks would like to submit written testimony, they can do so by emailing us at house.finance@akleg.gov. I'd also like to note that we do have with us Representative Co-Chair Shiragi as well as Representative Tomaszewski. And one more time, that email address is house.finance@akleg.gov. So with that, I do show, actually I'm going to go to the room first. I do have also with us Representative Hannon. And so on public testimony for House Bill 280, is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? I don't see anybody in the room who would like to testify on House Bill 280, so I'm going to go to the phones. We do have one person online, two people now online. The first one we're going to go to is Mr. Brian O'Leary, calling in from looks like New York. And Mr. O'Leary, if you could state your name and your affiliation, the company you're with, and or organization, and please proceed with your testimony. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon. My name is Brian O'Leary. I'm outside tax counsel for the Motion Picture Association. I'm here to offer testimony on House Bill 280. As a general proposition, I'd like to say that the Motion Picture Association and its member companies have substantial experience with states that are making a transition from the cost performance method of apportionment and sourcing of revenues to the market-based sourcing method of apportionment. And what we are hoping to do today, and I believe my colleague Melissa Patak is also on the phone, and I want, if I may, yield the floor to her to have opening comments and then for me to provide any technical additional guidance that would be helpful for the committee. If I appreciate that maybe out of protocol, but if I may offer Melissa to go first and offer her commentary.
Sure, we can do that. Ms. Melissa Patak, it looks like you're calling in from Los Angeles. If you can state your affiliation, yes, maybe your position as well as the organization that you're with.
Yes, thank you, Chair Foster. My name is Melissa Patak. I'm Vice President for State Government Affairs for the Western Region, for the Motion Picture Association. The MPA is the trade association for the major motion picture television and streaming companies. Our members are Amazon Studios, Disney, NBC Universal, Netflix, Paramount, Sony Pictures, and Warner Brothers. And as Brian said, I was going to introduce him, but you've already met him. He is our outside tax counsel, Brian O'Leary, who is in New York. The MPA supports the rationale and purpose of HB 280 to modernize Alaska's tax structure and adopt market sourcing as more than 30 states have done. And we understand the apportionment provision for the highly digitized businesses. As was discussed at your hearing last week, that will yield revenue for the state of Alaska from many of our members who have streaming services, which are highly digitized businesses. We have no objections with that provision. What we would like to talk about today is a similar provision that we would propose as an amendment that is would also base revenue for Alaska on customers. On the highly digitized business section of the bill, the relationship is about the streaming service and other digitized businesses to their customers. And if their customers are in Alaska, then that income is recognized in Alaska and taxes would be owed by the streaming companies. Similarly, national broadcasters and cable networks are seeking the same kind of treatment to base their tax on their customers. And national broadcast networks and cable networks have several kinds of customers. They have advertising customers, they have program distributors and licensing customers, and they do have some direct-to-consumer. And so we would our amendment would propose that where the customer is in Alaska, that portion of the company, the network broadcaster or the cable network, that portion of their income would be attributed to Alaska and taxes would be owed. So I'm going to rest there. We submitted a memo which goes into a little bit more detail. I'm going to defer to Brian to talk a little bit more about technical aspects, or we can hold that if there are questions.
Ms. Patak, just for clarification, I think you said that you have submitted the language of the proposed amendment in the memo. Is that correct, to the committee?
Yes, we did. Our proposed amendment language is in the memo.
Okay, thank you. Before we go to – I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say even the placement of our amendment would be page 9, line 28.
Okay, thank you. And I think you wanted to go to Mr. O'Leary next before we go to questions. Is that correct?
Sure. Yes, if you could open up Brian's line.
Mr. O'Leary, if you could
again. Your line is mute. Your line is unmuted.
Okay. Mr. O'Leary, go ahead.
Thank you, Melissa. Yes, through the chair, if I may just offer some of the technical elements that Melissa spoke to as a policy market sourcing as it relates to the media and entertainment industry has been considered by a number of states in transition from, again, cost of performance to market-based sourcing. There are 14 states, including many multi-state tax commission signatories that have adopted specific guidance for the media and entertainment industry, for broadcasters and streaming services to ensure a consistent approach for the revenues generated by those businesses under a market sourcing principle. And it is focused on attributing those revenues that are earned by in-state customers to the numerator of the sales apportionment formula. And what is important for our industry is a consistent approach to attributing those revenues, whether it is direct to consumer and our customer is the ultimate consumer, or a wholesale approach where, for example, and Melissa made reference to this, where the broadcaster is licensing to a local television station or a local cable operator or a satellite distribution company that has its own customers in the state. The point is that the market sourcing approach, and specifically the language that is in HB 280, which would be where the service is delivered to the in-state customer, makes a policy sense for the association and its members, and to provide the clarity on what that means, where the service is delivered in-state, what the amendment that Melissa referred to specifically does is address direct-to-consumer is based on where the consumer is physically located, based on their address, and where it is direct to a business customer, it's based on a term that is familiar for every business that is their commercial domicile. So the location of the customer is always going to be the guiding principle under this amendment, And for the individual, it's based on their address. For a business, it's based on their commercial domicile. And there, as I mentioned in my opening comment, there are 14 states that have transitioned to market-based sourcing, including many multi-state tax commission states that have adopted this principle. So, for example, states like Tennessee, Florida, Louisiana, Iowa, Idaho, and Texas have adopted this concept. And it's not anything other than providing the specific guidance that is so important for this industry and every business to ensure that we are in compliance with market-based sourcing for our industry, as HB 280 would propose to make that transition from cost to performance to market sourcing. So I'll pause there, and if there are any questions on what we're specifically referring to, happy to answer them. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. I'm looking to my staff and the finance staff. I don't see that memo in our folders. I am just curious, and I believe, Representative Hannon, that was your question. Representative Hannon. And it looks like we're passing those out now. Representative Hannon, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Foster. So without looking at the memo, I'm just trying to understand. So if I may, Mr. O'Leary, I'm thinking of, let's say, Super Bowl ads. They get talked about a lot as a high-ticket ad price. And let's just say I am a beer commercial at Super Bowl. Maybe I have horses delivering my beer in that commercial. You're saying that that taxation of that ad would go to where the buyer of the commercial was, so that beer's headquarters in, I think they're in Tennessee, not to the broadcast audience in Alaska.
Mr. O'Leary?
So through the chair, if I may, so if the Alaska viewer is watching through Peacock, their Peacock subscription, that revenue will be attributed 100% to where that subscriber is located. And if that Alaska viewer is watching through their local cable system, and that revenue, license revenue, would be attributed to where that subscriber is located. So the point I'm trying to be very clear about is that that revenue is picked up based on where the customer is located, which will include the revenue generated from the advertising. Separately from that, and this is where it's so important to understand the distinction between wholesale and retail. So when Peacock or Hulu or Dish or any of the other direct-to-consumer service providers are generating revenue from Alaska customers, just as they do in the states that I described, that revenue will be attributed to the state. If NBC is licensing directly to the satellite provider or the cable provider, again, those revenues are attributed to the state. The advertising revenue that the network picks up that isn't going to a Alaska subscriber of Peacock is not going to be picked up if it's being viewed in Iowa or New Mexico or some other jurisdiction. And this is the point. And the transition that the state is making is going from cost performance, where that advertising would be attributed to where I live in New York under a cost performance approach. But under a market approach, if you're watching the Super Bowl on Peacock, yes, absolutely, revenues will be attributed to Alaska based on those subscribers. And that is the trend of this industry. I think,
Mr. Chairman,
that's
can I do
exactly
Mr. O'Leary?
Why Alaska is making this decision.
Mr. O'Leary? Representative Sanning, Hannon, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Mr. O'Leary, I understand the paid streaming service. That's real clear. I want to know about the broadcast. I turned on my TV. There's the ad. Someone paid to have it beamed in, but I didn't pay for a service. Who's taxed?
So if you have an Alaska viewer that is
I'm sitting
receiving
in Alaska
free television, to the Oh, I'm sorry, through the chair, if I may. If I have an Alaska viewer that is watching free television and that television is including commercials that have advertisers from multiple jurisdictions, the revenue generated from that advertisement, just like in any other wholesale scenario, would be attributed to the commercial domicile of the advertiser. Just as if I was selling, for example, tires to a manufacturer of automotives, where that automotive is then sold to a local retailer in Alaska for purchase by a consumer in Alaska, it's the same principle. What we're trying to make clear is that where the customer is located is where the revenue is attributed. And in the, if I understand the question, if I'm asking about the wholesale scenario and I'm a viewer in Alaska that's not through a paid subscription and the television network is selling ads and no one is paying for a subscription, then the advertising revenue from that is attributed to the commercial domicile of the advertiser. That's just not the facts anymore. Like, the facts are exactly why Alaska is making this transition to market sourcing, because the world is going to direct the consumer. And that's why it's so important for us to have a consistent approach here, is that the world is watching through paid subscriptions, whether it's Peacock or Hulu or the direct broadcast satellite or cable franchises.
Okay, thank you. We've got a question, Representative Allard, and then Stapp. Representative Allard.
Thank you, and through the chair. Mr. O'Leary, thank you for being here. I just have a couple of questions. You're physically, and you're not a resident of Alaska, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, I appreciate your expertise on this. Also, how would this bill benefit you?
I'm sorry, through the chair, if I may have missed that question, if there was a question.
How would this bill benefit you?
Would it benefit me personally? It would benefit, I think, the state of Alaska, in as much as the company, the association that I represent, and the companies that are members of the association will inescapably pay more tax. So I presume that's why the policy change is being proposed. And from that perspective, the benefit, however, is consistency and clarity. So the benefit, if you want to call it that, for a media and entertainment company is that the state will now know who the media and entertainment company's customers are and how the revenue will be calculated based on that relationship that the companies that I represent have with Alaska customers. And that's what's so important for the association's membership, is that what we don't want to do is have disputes about viewership or whether someone is actually watching television in Alaska that is associated with programming that is generated by one of the members. We know that every time there is a subscriber, whether it's Peacock or Hulu or Apple TV, if they're an Alaska subscriber, yes, that means that tax will be paid on that revenue. That is the difference. That means taxes go up, but what we're not arguing about is what is the right method of apportionment. So for the sake of transparency and clarity, that is the value, at least that I see in this bill, is that we'll know what our measure of tax is, and the state will know what its measure of tax is. Cost performance or any other method is where the disputes take place. And I think that is part of the reason why this transition has happened across the country. And the approach that is in the Motion Picture Association membership proposal is how 14 other states have clarified what market sourcing is for the media and entertainment industry. So the clarity that we're talking about is really the benefit that I would see.
Representative Allard.
Thank you. Mr. O'Leary, I'm going to ask you to keep your answers more concise, and I don't really care about your opinion on anything other than what I'm going to ask you right now. Could you tell me how you financially benefit for this bill passing? I don't care about what other states are doing. I don't care about any of that stuff. I want to know, full transparency, how is your Motion Picture Association financially benefiting from this bill?
And we're going to pay more taxes through the chair. We're going to pay more taxes. So I don't know if you would consider that a financial benefit. It's a financial responsibility based on a change of law.
Thank you, Mr. O'Leary.
And Mr. O'Leary, just to follow up on that, if this amendment were to pass, I think, going back to the question, if this amendment were to pass, I assume that means that maybe members of the Motion Picture Association would pay less in taxes if we assume this methodology. Is that what the MPA is seeking, ultimately?
Mr. Chair, may I allow my colleague, Melissa Patak, to answer that question?
Sure. Ms. Patak?
Thank you. Through the chair, this is Melissa Patak. The benefit is certainty, consistency, and predictability, and eliminating audits. That's the benefit to the MPA members. On the streaming side, they're going to pay more taxes. That's clear if HB 280 advances under the highly digitized language. That's clear. That's, paying more taxes, I think everybody would agree, is not necessarily a benefit. But we understand this is the modern trend, and we accept when there is a relationship between the company and an Alaska resident, tax, that portion of the company's income should be recognized and attributed to Alaska. And so Alaska will realize more revenue. Yes, we recognize Alaska doesn't have a large number of national advertisers. And so there will not be a huge increase in revenue for Alaska, but that's not necessarily a savings for our member companies because they're paying that tax in the state where the advertiser has its commercial domicile. But the money that Alaska will receive is in the relationship between the network, the broadcast or cable network, and its customers, which consist of, is it CGI or GPI, the main cable company, which is an Alaska company. So the revenue that is attributable in that relationship will be recognized in Alaska, and our companies will pay tax on that, as well as to the satellite companies. And there also is direct relationships with local stations where our companies license their content directly through syndication, and the revenue they receive for that will be attributed to Alaska. So our companies will be paying more tax than they are paying today in Alaska, but this method gives certainty both to the Department of Revenue as well as to our member companies. And there is, I can't put a dollar price tag on certainty and consistency, but there is a value to that, and that is why we are seeking this amendment.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Patak. We're going to go back to Representative Allard here, but I think what I'm hearing is I know that we all agree that if this bill were to be passed, it would be more revenue for the state of Alaska, and that's not of contention. But what the question is going back to the amendment, how does that affect how much revenue comes to the state? And I think what you're saying is that another way to look at that, another consideration is the certainty and whether or not the audits occur. And there are just other points, I guess, to consider. So thank you. Representative Allard wants to follow up. Representative Allard?
Yeah, thank you. And thank you, Ms. Patak, for being here today. I appreciate it. Through the chair. So just for clarification, you mentioned something. Well, first I want to say I think you think everybody's in favor of this bill, and that's not accurate. Number two, can you tell me when you said streaming, are you saying that the fees for the individuals in the state of Alaska, the streaming costs will go up?
No, that's not at all what I meant. Through the chair, if I may answer. That is not at all what I meant. I meant our companies, Netflix, Peacock, Hulu, Disney Plus, they will pay more taxes in Alaska. It doesn't mean that the price of streaming is going up. This is not a pass-through kind of tax. This is an income tax to the company.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Representative Stout.
Thank Co-Chair Foster, the chair, to I guess Ms. Patak or Mr. O'Leary. Okay, so I am having a challenging time parsing what exactly you are trying to do here. So I'm going to ask that we very simply kind of walk through the steps here so you can help me better understand. So I'm reading. So the nucleus of the bill goes from cost performance to market-based sourcing, which basically means we are accounting the sale at where it takes place, i.e., ad revenue, the custom rentals in Alaska. So we're attributing all of that market activity to the numerator in the apportionment factor. I've read what you are saying in your language here about five times, and I don't quite understand how you are parsing the definition of audience. So what is the actual problem with the definition of audience, and can you articulate that in a clear and concise manner through the chair?
Through the chair, this is Melissa. I will take some of that question and then I'll defer to Brian on some of it. I'm going to defer to Brian on what's in the numerator, but I will take the question on the audience part. The audience it's an outdated form of measuring revenue. For example, there are many, many cable networks, Comedy Central, House and Garden TV. The Alaska audience for each of those cable networks is going to have to be determined. And that is what I mean, you know, the market sourcing will reduce the number of audits because it will have a consistent and certain methodology. When you're talking about audience, these cable networks have very niche audiences, and the companies are going to want to show what that audience is, and it's not going to be a uniform audience for Alaska residents. And so that's what we're talking about, why we say it's an outdated apportionment method. And I'll defer to Brian on the formula, the mechanics of the formula.
Mr. O'Leary.
Thank you, Melissa. Through the chair, in terms of what's in the numerator, getting to the market sourcing concept, it's based on your customer's location. And if it's a subscriber, whether it's on NBC.com or Peacock or Hulu, if the subscriber is based in Alaska and they're paying a fee for that service, then it is attributed to the state 100%. And just as it would be if a media company is licensing syndicated programming to a local television station or their signal to a cable operator. The point that Melissa is making about audience presumes that those companies know who is actually watching and where they're watching. And that is the outdated method, and why the state that, again, Alaska is going to make a decision based on its policy needs. What is helpful, I do believe, is what other MTC states have done, because this is an MTC proposal, and that's where other states have transitioned to commercial domicile, because that is a method of determining where a media company's customer is located. That's what would be included in the numerator, is whatever those payments are received from a individual based on their residence, from a business based on their commercial domicile. If whatever happens in Alaska from a customer perspective is attributed 100% to the Alaska numerator.
Representative Stout.
Yeah, follow up. Okay. So we're gonna parse this. Thank you, Co-Chair, through the chair. Okay. So obviously, if I have a subscription, it is relatively easy for me to understand that of where I live. By changing the definition to, quote, commercial domicile, you tell me that these companies don't track their audience that are watching without subscriptions, so this regular TV, as Rep Hanna was talking about. Yet, if they're not tracking them, how would I properly apportion my net profits based off, you know, my sales in the state? And it's relatively simple. And this bill, it's a single sales factor, such as gross receipts. If I were to adopt your definition, is the state still capturing those people who are, you know, being advertised to on a net profitability, but not under a direct commercial domicile subscription? Through the chair.
Mr. O'Leary?
Through the chair, and the answer is yes. If that media company is licensing to, for example, a station or a cable operator, and that's where the distinction is made between retail and wholesale. So if I'm a network and my network is NBC or ABC and I'm licensing to DirecTV or the Alaska cable operator, I don't know who DirecTV or that Alaska cable operator's customers are. That's proprietary. But those companies that are the distributors do know who their customers are. And that is the consistency, is that every time a company has direct consumer subscription, 100% of that revenue under the MPA's proposal, which is an interpretation of market, would be attributed. And where the network has a customer that is a business that is domiciled in Alaska, like that cable company, 100% of that revenue would be attributed. So it really is drawing the distinction between operating at wholesale and operating at retail.
Okay, follow.
Retail, 100% of that revenue is going to be attributed to the state. Wholesale, where is the commercial domicile of that customer?
Okay.
If it's a cable operator domiciled in Alaska or a television station domiciled in Alaska, 100% of that revenue would be attributed to the state, even if not all of their customers are in Alaska.
Mr.
So
O'Leary.
In that regard, it's focused exclusively on who the customer is.
Mr. O'Leary?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Co-Chair. To the Chair, Mr. O'Leary. Mr. O'Leary, I'm going to be very concise and very precise in my question. I'm going to ask you to do the same thing because you're really starting to piss me off, all right? So, sorry, Co-Chair Foster.
Thank you.
So let's take the example of NBC selling to, let's say, Microcom or GCI. If I adopt the language in this amendment, where does that sale actually take place? Again, the third-party vendor is doing all their business in Alaska, but they're buying a subscription or they're selling an advertising license from the vendor. Okay, that transaction to an Alaskan company from one of your members, if I adopt your language, where is that sale taking place? Is it taking place in Alaska, or is it taking place where NBC is domiciled? Through the chair.
Mr. O'Leary?
Through the chair, where the customer is domiciled.
Follow up. So in the example I gave you, the customer is domiciled in Alaska, so we would be including that contract sale in Alaska, correct, through the chair?
Mr. O'Leary?
Through the chair, that is correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Stepp, do you have a follow-up? No. Do we have any other questions? I'm going to circle back to Mr. O'Leary and Ms. Patak. Is there anything else that you wanted to say with regard to the questions that were asked?
The only thing I would add is, through the chair, thank you for this consideration.
Okay. Appreciate your very robust interaction with regard to public testimony today. But I think this is important because if somebody decides to carry this amendment, it's important that we understand it. So thank you very much for calling in. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify? I don't see any, so I'm going to go ahead and close. Oh, I'm sorry. It looks like we do have another person online. That is Rachel Posey calling in from Anchorage. Ms. Posey, if you can state your name and your affiliation if you're with an organization.
Hi, yes. My name is Rachel Posey, and I'm just calling in to express my support for HB 280. I think this is a common sense amendment that will bring Alaska's tax codes into alignment with most of the rest of the country, and we are in desperate need of revenue, especially for things like public education. So I hope that we get bipartisan support for this measure and that it continues on. So I just want to express my support. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Ms. Posey. I don't see any questions of the committee. So with that, if there is nothing else on HB 280, Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Foster. I would like to hear from the Department of Revenue on this definition on the motion picture industry, because I now conceptually can understand it, but I want to make sure that we're not creating a problem for a collection of revenue, where we do it in some cases for advertisement and in other cases not. So I'd like to know the Department of Revenue's read on the ability to, if we were considering this amendment, because I don't think they've seen it, and to see whether that makes our collection for broadcast revenue more complicated. And I think we all understand when it's a highly digitized business, that's pretty clean cut. But when we're getting into these broadcast ones, I want to make sure that we can administer it and collect revenue if we're due it.
Great. Thank you, Representative Hannon. I think I'm looking to my staff, and he will reach out to the Department of Revenue, make sure that they look at the memo that was provided, maybe give us an analysis and assessment of that. And when we come back to our next meeting, we'll report back on that. So thank you all very much. And I'm going to close public testimony on House Bill 280. That's the digitized business bill. And with that, if folks would like to submit written testimony, they can still do so by emailing us at house.finance@akleg.gov. We're going to take a quick break while we switch over to the next part of our finance meeting, which is presentation from the Department of Health, and I'll be passing the gavel off to Co-Chair Josephson. So with that, briefities.
Okay, we're back on record in the Al Adams Room, 2:16 p.m., February the 18th. We're going to hear as much of two presentations as we can. I'm going to be draconian about asking folks to hold questions, take notes in the margins, and we'll return to them when we can. These officials have already been recalendared. They were, I think, last week. But we have a hard stop of three, and that's the predicament. So we'll now hear two presentations from the Department of Health. The first will be their FY27 departmental budget overview. Then we will hear an update on House Resolution 1, a Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, and Medicaid implementation. With us today from the department is Commissioner Hedberg, Deputy Commissioner Ritchie, Ms. Halloran, the Assistant Commissioner. If the three of you will come forward, put yourselves on the record, you can begin your presentation.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Heidi Hedberg. We are going to start with the department budget overview, and I will pass it to Pam Halloran, Assistant Commissioner.
Ms. Halloran.
For the record, my name is Pam Halloran. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Health. I'm going to speak very quickly. I understand we're lacking on time, but I'm also going to try and roll in Governor Amend items, which was announced this morning. So I have incorporated that into my notes, but not my slides.
Okay.
And I'll try and go very quickly, but feel free to stop me anytime. The first budget is the entire operating budget for the department. It takes us from final authorized to management plan plus supplemental. The middle bar represents both. And the FY27 governor's proposed budget. The current FY26 budget is $3.9 million. The supplemental budget rolls in $778.1 million into the budget. The supplemental proposal for the department comprises primarily a federal authority for Medicaid based on the department's December projections. Between 25 and 26, there is an overall 11.4% increase. During that same time period, UGF increased 6.3%. So that's between 25 and 26. The FY27 governor's proposed budget, as released last December for the department, was $3.82 billion. Not reflected on this slide is the governor's amended budget released this morning, which increases the Department of Health's budget to $4.3 billion. Of that budget, $1.1 is UGF.
Okay.
Moving on to Medicaid services, this slide and forthcoming slides will continue to take you from final authorized to management plan plus supplemental to FY27 governor's budget. To start with the FY26 supplemental budget, the budget includes a reappropriation of funding to support behavioral health clinic services. For FY26 and FY27, the legislature appropriated $13,750,000 to support clinic behavioral health services, and $10 million was included in the governor's budget for FY26. The FY27 increment, the amount of $10 million, was not in the December release for the governor's budget. That was included in the supplemental budget as a multi-year. The balance will be carried forward into FY27. The supplemental budget also includes Medicaid projections associated with the projections that the department submitted to the legislature yesterday. For that, there is a slight decrease in the projection. So the supplemental budget includes a decrement of $2 million general fund and $61 million federal authority. The final request in the supplemental is to extend Inter-I is an assessment tool used for home and community-based waiver services implemented by the Division of Senior and Disability Services. The balance of that will be utilized through 2031. The FY27 governor's proposed budget maintains open-ended federal receipt authority for Medicaid services. This flexibility allows the department to fully leverage federal funding for claims payments and tribal reclaiming. Federal receipts vary with the federal medical assistance percentage, or FMAP, and enrollment and service utilization, factors that cannot be always predicted within the Medicaid appropriation. This morning's governor's amended budget incorporated the yesterday's projections, and that into governor's amended, that included $334 million federal authority and $42.3 million UGF into the Medicaid governor's amended budget.
Mm-hmm. For the record.
What's that? Yes, AC Halloran, can you give us those numbers again? 334, this is for FY27 amendments. 334 was federal in millions.
Through the chair, Rep. Bynum, yes, that was $334 million federal and $42,288,100 GF.
For the record, this is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. One item that I just wanted to highlight for the legislature that impacts both the supplemental request and the government request for Medicaid is that every 4 to 5 years, there's an additional week of provider payments, and it is a natural occurrence of timing. That occurs in FY26. So you'll see a approximately 14.7% general fund impact in FY26 that it's included in the supplemental request. In FY27, we do see a small decrease in our federal match of about 1.5%. That's part of an annual process that occurs regularly. There's a federal formula that is updated annually for all states. Our FMAP, our federal match, changes on an annual basis. Over the last 2 years, we've received small increases of around between 0.8% to just over 1%. This next year, beginning in federal fiscal year 27, we're seeing a slight decrease of 1.0%. And so that is also factored into the governor's amend. So I wanted to highlight those two items because they're not typical.
Okay. All right. Let's go to rebasing, or rather reclaiming and rebates.
For the record, this is Emily Ricci, and moving on to slide 4, one area that's important for the department to highlight is the work that we do to ensure that general funds are preserved as much as possible. There's two main avenues that the division, that the department engages in. These are all managed through the Division of Healthcare Services. You can see the column on the right, something called tribal reclaiming savings. And these are when an individual receives who is covered through Medicaid and who is an Alaska Native receives services outside of a tribal health organization. The state can complete certain paperwork. We have to have something called a coordinated care agreement, but we can request 100% federal funding for the cost of those services. Right now it is very administrative intensive, so we have a team in the Division of Healthcare Services that's really focused on making sure as many services as possible that are eligible receive that 100% federal match. You'll see a small change between FY24 and FY25. A decrease there. The FY24 number is a little bit higher than it otherwise would be. There were some claims that occurred in FY23 that got processed in FY24 that resulted in a bump. On the right hand of the slide, the Medicaid program is eligible for drug rebate recoveries. So these are payments from drug manufacturers back to the Medicaid program in alignment with utilization of certain drugs and medications. And so you see the savings on the right hand side.
Rafaela, can you hold your question until we...
It's just a really short one, Chair. It's just a clarification.
Is it a singular question? Is
yes.
It, please
I
go ahead.
No follow-up.
Please go ahead.
Could you explain why we didn't process the 23 in 2023 and we did it in 2024 instead for that slight bump? See?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. It had to do with a travel broker at the time that was processing travel claims, and when those came, some of the claims were for FY23, but we actually processed them in FY24, and so it's specifically associated with some travel claims from that time period.
Thank you. No follow-up.
Please proceed, Deputy Commissioner.
So moving on to slide 5, just one item to highlight for the committee, and I will be very brief on this slide, is just that it is important to look at the overall health of our population as well as the number of chronic conditions, because that translates into medical need among the Medicaid population and the number of services that they need access to and the support that we provide. So one thing, we're kind of thinking always about short-term savings, immediate savings with the tribal reclaiming and the pharmacy rebate recoveries you saw on the prior slide. But we also need to be thinking long-term, how can we improve the overall health of the Medicaid population, because we know that that translates into larger Medicaid costs. And ultimately, primarily, we want to make sure our population is healthier.
Okay.
For the record, Pam Halloran, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Health, taking you on to Healthcare Services, the Division of Healthcare Services. In the governor's amended governor's budget initial release, there was an $812,500 increase related to Alaska care and salary adjustments. And then to stay on 27 for just a moment and roll into governor's amended items, there were some increases in the governor's amended budget, including $181,200 related to the implementation of a classification study. This study was for community care licensing specialists that will soon become care facility licensing surveyors. This impacts 16 positions. Also in the governor's amended budget is a $2 million federal authority increase to support Medicaid system modernization efforts related to advanced planning documents and work around a recently awarded school-based services grant.
So the total FY27 increase in the amendments for healthcare services is what? Is it about $2.2 million?
The governor's amended budget for the healthcare services is $29.5 million. Of that, $9.3 million is UGF, and I can tell you the increase. No, I can't. My paperwork didn't do math, and I can't.
I think it was two numbers totaling just over $2 million is what I heard.
Right.
Okay, let's go to behavioral health.
For FY27, for the Division of Behavioral Health, there were two significant budget changes I wanted to highlight for you. There's a transfer of community services for residential care grants from the Department of the Department of Family and Community Services. This is a transfer of grant services for children's emergency service providers and includes a $474,300 GF transfer into that department. The budget also includes federal receipt authority for the Crisis Contact Center in the amount of $585,000. This allows the division to leverage Medicaid administrative costs at 50% for 30% of the anticipated costs for the Crisis Call Center.
Moving on to, for the record, this is Emily Ricci with the Department of Health. Moving on to slide 8, this is a slide that I think we shared in past years, and we wanted to just provide the committee with an updated slide. This represents the totality of the behavioral health spending through Medicaid and the grants that are administered through the Division of Behavioral Health. We know that there has been a strong focus on building out community behavioral health services through what's called a Section 1115 innovation waiver. It was a priority from the legislature and from the department. We also know that there is a focus on behavioral health grants that are being paid out to communities. And so we wanted to provide a snapshot of what both the combination of Medicaid payments and behavioral health grants has looked like over the past several years. And Medicaid services, specifically the new Section 1115 behavioral health services, came online in 2019. That was right before the pandemic. And so you can kind of see a slow start there. But over the past few years, we've worked hard to build those out, and you see that investment in this slide.
And if folks are interested, I know there's a lot going on in this slide deck, but the subcommittee took this up yesterday afternoon. So if you've got free time, most of us don't, that was February 17th, yesterday afternoon. You could listen to detailed discussion about that. Slide 9.
Slide 9 represents a division of Senior and Disability Services. FY27 significant budget changes solely includes an Alaska care adjustments and salary adjustments just over $1 million. To provide an update, I wanted to provide an update in regard to one item which was added by the legislature to the budget for senior and disability services last year. That was $2.5 million in general fund, and that was to support and stabilize senior centers. The funding has been distributed to 60 grantees as part of the quarter three grant payment, and the funding is very important because Alaskan seniors who participate in these programs do not necessarily need to be Medicaid eligible. The funding supports all seniors.
Okay. Rep. Tomaszewski, do you have a question?
Thank you. Yes, thank you, Co-Chair. How many senior centers do we have in the state?
To the Chair, Representative Tomaszewski, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. I will follow up with you on that.
Okay, because follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
I believe you said you gave grants to 60. So I'm assuming you have more than 60 then.
Through the Chair, Representative Tomaszewski, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. I don't know that all 62 of those awards, 60 or 62 of those awards, would necessarily qualify as senior centers, but we can get you a list of the grantees.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, public assistance. And we have our division director with us, too.
For the division of, or for the record, this is Pam Halloran, Assistant Commissioner. For the Division of Public Assistance, there are a number of FY26 supplemental budget items that we wanted to highlight for you today. There is a proposal to extend new investment projects for SNAP through FY28. That's in the amount of just under $6 million. This item will provide adequate time for the division to complete work associated with streamlining their tools that their eligibility technicians use to serve Alaskans. There is also a proposal to add authority for eligibility systems amid rising operational costs in the amount of $21 million. This is a rather large request, so I'll spend a little bit of time on it. The division has relied on multi-year funding previously, and that funding ended at the end of FY25. That has created a budget gap amid these rising operational costs that have continuously rise where they relied on that multi-year funding. So what we've done is we've taken the FY23 actual cost of the operating costs of these systems, and we've compared them with the actual operating costs for the systems in FY26. This is for the maintenance, the licensing, the vendor support, and things like that for the systems. Our systems our eligibility technicians use every day. They provide the case management skills. They receive the online applications. They provide the workflow that the eligibility technicians need to do to receive the information and then disperse payments. The supplemental budget also includes an increase of $5.9 million to maintain the virtual contact center. And I should mention that the governor's amended budget, if I can backtrack for just a moment, the governor's amended budget also includes a $21 million for the eligibility systems operating costs, as well as an increment in the amount of $8 million for the virtual contact center. So the Virtual Contact Center supplemental budget request is $5.9 million. That's because we were able to leverage some areas of our department between last summer when we realized that this wouldn't be funded and now. So we're asking for the delta. Then there's the $8 million, which is the amount that the Division of Public Assistance needs for the Virtual Contact Center in FY27. There's also a federal authority request to address rising WIC food costs in the amount of $4.5 million. Finally, there's a request to maintain senior benefits programs for seniors so that seniors can have access to their benefits as allowable and as eligible for the amounts that are listed in statute. For the FY27 budget, there's also a salary and health insurance adjustment in the amount of $2.7 million. There's also an additional senior benefits payment program that aligns with the fiscal note in the amount of $480,300. That's GF as well. There's also a $120,000 federal increase related to the same classification study that we discussed. That we've discussed when we were on the healthcare services. This affects 12 positions within the Division of Public Assistance.
Okay. Rep. Calvin, did you have a quick question? Slide 10.
I can wait until okay. this is done, and then okay. I do have a question
okay.
on that slide.
Let's go to slide 11. And, of course, where the committee sees FY26 supplemental items, that's on the floor in 55 minutes. Slide 11.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg. So on slide 12, what I just want to highlight for this committee is we really appreciate the investments into the Division of Public Assistance. The division has been under a lot of focus, and it's really about modernizing the systems to decrease the human errors that happen as we are processing applications. So for the committee, very quickly, the Alaska Connect portal is for clients. We launched it last year. We are launching the second phase of that portal so that clients will be able to see where they're at with the application being processed, when their interviews are need to be rescheduled. This is going to be really important because it will decrease the call volume into the virtual contact center and really support the clients with understanding where their application is in the process. As you are aware, there's many legacy systems within the division, and so we do have a contract with a pretty phenomenal IT vendor that initiated in October of 2025 to move our Medicaid program off of the legacy system, and that is on target and will be completed in 2027. In addition, this spring, we will be posting an RFP to identify a vendor that will then move our SNAP program off of its legacy system. Again, that should be completed in 2027. All of that is really focusing on our integrated eligibility system. We have many milestones. We're happy to provide the documents that outline the milestones and the increments to the committee so you can actually see the work that is underway. But it will culminate in what is known as the integrated eligibility system that will really help modernize a lot of the work by the eligibility technicians. In addition, Worker Assist is a tool, so it is a secured environment with all the policies and procedures. It will support our eligibility technicians. There will be a little chatbot. They can enter their question, and it will pull from the policies. That will really help with expediting, trying to find the information out of the policies and ensure that there's consistency in application of the policies. For childcare, that is also within public health, we launched last spring the modernization of that system, and we have seen a provider go through and receive their license in less than 30 days. We are mobile, so we have DP in a box. We go out to communities without an office, and that has been really successful. And then finally, the eligibility class study is underway, and it should be completed this summer.
Okay.
All right. For the record, Pam Halloran. The governor's budget for the Division of Public Health includes a $4.4 million opioid settlement disbursement, and that represents the third year. There's also a $2.6 million increase related to health insurance and salary adjustments for staff.
Support services.
Moving on to the department support services, there are two significant budget changes, and you've probably been hearing about these as you've been talking to the departments. For the Department of Health, we are receiving some shared services of Alaska positions back. A total of five positions will return to the department. That increases our accounts payable fiscal management unit to 11 positions. The IT classification study which it increases our budget by an anticipated $1.2 million. And with that, interagency receipt authority has been transferred into the department to support those costs.
Okay. Please continue.
The Health Transformation and Innovation is a new results delivery unit that is being established for FY26 to support costs related to the Rural Health Transformation Fund. $272.2 million is in the supplemental budget. There's also a request in a language item in the governor's amended budget for the Rural Health Transformation Program as well.
Okay. We just did something that was efficient, maybe not super thorough or always edifying, not because of our fine folks at the department, but because of time. The Rural Health Transformation Fund we're about to discuss in some ways in the second presentation. But let's entertain some questions now. Representative Stapp, then Hannah.
Thank you, Coach Justin, through the chair. Wonderful folks at the Health Department, always great to see you. Opioid settlement funds, distribution and amounts. What is the total amount of money that we currently received in the opioid settlement funds? First question through the chair.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, through the chair. Representative, there's about $100 million in many different settlement funds that the state has received.
Mr. Coacher.
Rep. Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Coacher Justin, to the chair. How are we currently distributing those? And are you breaking out? Is that $100 million? I mean, I asked specifically on opioid. Do you know how to break those out, or is it just the $100 million in total funds? So I guess that's technically two questions. My apologies, through the chair.
Commissioner.
Through the chair, Representative. So over the past 2 years, we've allocated $8.78 million. That allocation is with a committee, with the Opioid Settlement Steering Committee, that is in compliance with the opioid settlement, and that goes out to communities that is in alignment with a settlement agreement.
Mr. Coacher.
Follow-up, Rep. Stapp.
Okay, so we've received about over $100 million, and we've only allocated $8.8 million. So what are we doing with the rest of the money, through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative. So the settlement agreements are payouts. Some of them are 7 years, some of them are 10 years, some of them go all the way to 16 years. So the state has not received a full $100 million. We are receiving allocations over each year. We can follow up with you on the different settlements and the length of the opioid settlement agreement and the amount we've received and then what we'll receive in future lump payments.
Okay, last follow-up.
Yes, last follow-up.
Yeah, thank you, Coach Justin, to the chair. Really simple. When you're getting the money in, are you getting the money out? Or are we holding on to some, through the chair?
Commissioner.
Through the chair, Representative, all of the money is going out.
Thank you.
Representative Hannon, and then Galvin, sorry.
Thank you. I've got a couple of small questions on a number of different slides. So first, in the additional supplemental requests that we received yesterday that are being processed today, is some of that just federal authority to receive the rural health care transformation monies?
Through the chair.
A.C. Halloran.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative I almost appointed myself as a Pam Halloran.
Do that.
The funding for the Rural Health Transformation Program for FY27, it tricked me too. It's in the language section of the budget.
Okay. Follow up,
Representative Hannon.
On the support services, transferring five positions from the department administration. This is a little tougher for you guys because, of course, they were taken from you when you were in a mega department, and now you're not. So I guess instead of the other departments I've asked, is this the same number that went away? But I'm going to ask it a different way. Do you feel that that is an adequate number to address the support that you need for your department?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, we believe that we can make it work, whether or not it's the same amount of positions that went out, since obviously we were the Department of Health and Social Services at the time that are coming back. I can't really tell. But we've incorporated some processes into the accounting system that we're really excited about, where we're leveraging it, and we're going to be entering more entries into the accounting system that used to go into a portal for fiscal staff to receive and enter. Now things are going to be right in the accounting system, so we believe we should be able to make it work.
Thank you. And then I have one more little question.
On
page 5, when you're looking at cost per number of chronic conditions, and I'm presuming that's one client or one individual. So they cost us $28,000 or $29,000 if they have two, but they cost us, if they have seven chronic conditions, $72,000. Is that correct?
D.C. Ritchie.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon. These are averages looked at over a year period. But yes, in general, individuals that have seven or more, chronic conditions on average, incurred about $72,000 in medical services.
Thank you.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you. We can stick on this slide because I do have a quick question that's a follow-up. So then can you tell us of this how many dollars are being spent on, let's say, the eight or more diagnoses in all? What you're sharing here is per patient. So what I'm trying to understand is of these, or maybe you could just give us a quick, brief analysis of people rest generally in the, you know, 4 to 5. And so, you know, of all the public health dollars we're spending in this area, we're mostly at the 8 or more diagnoses, and that's our issue. If there's only a couple of the 8 or more, as opposed to mostly in the 0 or 1, then you would want to focus on the 0 to 1 and primary care. I'm just trying to understand what this means to us.
DC Ritchie.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin. For the record, this is Emily Ritchie. So this information is taken from the MESA, so it is all available. There's just over 850 individuals that had 8 conditions or more for a total of just over $80 million. But I think in general, there's when you think about the population of any sort of health insurance program, whether it's Medicaid or state plans or anything else, there's a portion that is generally healthy, right? And maybe the goal there, the intervention that you want to think about from a population health level is to keep them healthy, right? To keep, to support them in staying healthy so they don't incur more, you know, chronic conditions. Then on the other extreme, you have about 5% of the population that usually incurs anywhere from, like, you know, about 50% of the total cost, and there's interventions there that might look really different. So I think for kind of every segment of the population, there are different ways that you can think about what would be helpful from a public health perspective.
Thank you very much. May I ask another follow-up,
Rep.
please? Thank you. This is it's slide 10. Thank you for sharing that a little bit more of the highlights in terms of the steps to getting to the eligibility so that we don't have the error rate that incurred so much of our, on the next slide presentation, we'll hear more about that, SNAP error rate and other things that are error rates that cost us to be fined. So this is, I really appreciate the time that you spent and that we've decided to invest in the $8 million and then the $21 million. I look forward to seeing the steps that will get us to the error rate that's less than 6%, I think it needs to be, by 2030. So if you would please send those forward, that would be very helpful. And I have one more question.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you. And this one is related to our senior and disability services. And I apologize, I think you may have already covered it, but it was going so fast, I'm not sure. So we know that from the Guidehouse presentation that you have settled on the behavioral health portion of that in terms of where to invest for now for 2027 is what I think was reported from the OMB. And so my question is, on slide 9, I think you might have mentioned that there was additional GF for that, and I'm trying to understand, is that going to help address another portion of the Guidehouse, which was what we in this committee heard about so much, that those care providers for seniors and for disabilities, particularly for those caring for those with disabilities in Alaska, are not making enough wages. In fact, what we heard was they're making 32% below the national average wage. And so, and we heard about it all night long in public testimony last year. So what I'm hoping to know is, are you saying that the governor supplanted that in the last day? I didn't get to hear what that was about.
DC Ritchie.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin. No, that is not included in the governor's budget. That would have been included in the Medicaid component, as would any other rate increase or adjustment that is considered by the department or the legislature. What is included in this slide is funding to support something called the InterEye tool, and that is an assessment tool that the division has been building out for many years, I think with a lot of support from the legislature and stakeholders, because that will allow a transition to person-directed care within a budget and will be a way for us to more efficiently and effectively meet individuals' needs. So that's what's mentioned in this slide is that InterEye tool.
Okay.
Thank you. Follow up, if I may. I just want to double check. Is that the $2.5 million GF that was mentioned on that slide, or is that for senior centers or something else?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, the $2.5 million was specifically for senior centers.
Thank you.
For senior services.
Representative Bynum, then Moore.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I was just hoping that we'd be able to get to the next item because I think this is a really important issue, and I just don't know what we're going to be able to do to cover in 8 minutes for this very important issue.
Well,
so that was my only concern. Thank you.
Sure. I appreciate that, and I agree. All I know is we're not going over the 3 o'clock hour. It just is not happening. Representative Moore.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. I'm going to wait on my questions. Okay. I can submit them in writing.
All right. I apologize for the brusque presentation. So let's take a stab at the HR1 overview, if that's easy to pull up. Okay.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner for the Department of Health. So I'm going to start with SNAP and talk about the 3 primary changes related to the HR1 bill that was implemented and signed into law on July of 2025. And then I'll hand it over to Deputy Commissioner Ritchie that will talk about Medicaid.
Okay.
So on slide 3, there was an age change for the able-bodied adults without dependents. It shifted from 18 to 54 to 18 to 64. This impacts less than 800 households in Alaska. In addition, there was an elimination of veterans, homeless individuals, and former foster youth up to age 24. And there was a narrowing of the age perimeter for caregivers exempt, limited to parents of children under 14. It used to be 18. There's also expanding, so Alaska Natives and American Indians are exempt from the able-bodied adults with dependents work requirement. Okay. On slide 4, I want to just give some context to the SNAP air rate penalty. And this, for historical context, the SNAP payment error rate is not a measure of fraud. This can result from mistakes made by the eligibility technicians or clients, which is why we're so focused on our IT modernization to take out that human error element that are really administratively focused. Since we've come into our role, we've really been focusing on addressing those prior issues, and we've made a lot of headway. Again, historical context for just awareness when it comes to our payment error rate. I think you guys are well known that last year's error rate was 24%, which is above the 15%. In 2011 to 2014, it was less than 1%. USDA changes their methodology. In 2017 to 2019, it hovered between 6 to 11%. During the pandemic, there was none. And then we saw the significant spike, which we've talked with this committee about significantly. What's important for this committee to hear with this payment error rate, this is the benefit amount, and there's a cost sharing. So states that have less than 6%, and there's only 9 currently, they would not have a cost share. States that have more than a 10%, they will have a 15% cost share, and you can see what that estimate would be based off of the FFY25 benefits. This is not going to take effect until 2030. But right now, our focus within the division is that we need to really focus in on our IT modernization, supporting our eligibility technicians so we can drive down our error rates to be below that 10%. We are plateau right now, and then we anticipate going down further as we continue to implement our IT modernizations and support our staff. Okay. And then finally, the administrative cost shift, this is a federal program. It has always been traditionally 50-50. There's a shift to 75-25. This has nothing to do with the penalty error rates. This applies to all states, and it's estimated 10.7. I'll draw your attention. This is based off of four quarters. And so in the government for 27, you'll actually see it less. That's based off of three quarters because this goes into effect October of 2027.
For the record, this is Emily Ricci with the Department of Health. Moving on to slide six, we're going to talk about the impacts to Medicaid from HR 1 in three buckets. The first is financing mechanisms. What's important to understand is that the changes to the financing mechanisms in the bill don't affect Alaska. We don't rely on provider taxes or state-directed payments. Those were the two mechanisms, primary mechanisms that were changed, and we don't have those.
Okay.
Moving on to slide seven, there were also changes to eligibility requirements for the Medicaid expansion population. So that is right now as of February, that's about 61,000 adults in Alaska who are covered through Medicaid expansion. And beginning at the beginning January 1, 2027, individuals between 19 and 64 will have to complete 80 hours in the month prior to eligibility review of work or other qualifying activities, including job training, education, or volunteer service. We are still waiting for details from CMS on how to define many of these things. There is also an option for seasonal income flexibility that I know our delegation worked hard on, and will provide some more flexibility for individuals in like tourism, commercial fishing, or things like that. There is also a potential good faith waiver that would allow states to phase in these requirements through the end of 2028. Again, we know this is an area our delegation focused on as the bill was being drafted. So there are exemptions to these community engagement requirements. There's mandatory, and then there is optional. You can see a list of mandatory exemptions here. In the interest of time, I'm not going to read through them, but they are quite extensive, and they impact Alaska. Mm-hmm.
And Senator Sullivan described them today. Real quickly, Rep. Allard.
It's a question to you, Chair. Are we going to come back and be able to go through this? Like, this is great, and it's very quick, but... Uh-huh. Are we going to be able to come back and ask for questions? Because this is a lot.
It is. I see these officials in town all the time. I don't know that they live here. I think they don't. But we will have them back. We'll find a way to do that.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay.
Moving on to the next slide, slide nine. These are Medicaid. These are optional exemptions, short-term hardship exemptions that are also important for Alaska. One thing to note is that... this morning, we released some preliminary estimates for individuals who we could identify in our system would qualify for these exemptions in the Medicaid expansion coverage group based on February reporting. And again, using some illustrative preliminary data, we estimate that about 69% of individuals in the Medicaid expansion category right now would qualify for an automatic exemption based on data that we have in our systems.
What percent again?
69%.
Okay.
So, again, we'll spend more time talking about this. You'll hear more about this over the months to come, but we wanted to share that update with you as that is available online right now. Thank you.
I want to thank you, too. My apologies for the rapidity of the pace here. We're going to adjourn today. That concludes our business. Our next House Finance Committee meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, February 19th at 1:30. At that meeting, we'll hear the Office of Management and Budget give two presentations. The first will be on the Governor's FY27 budget amendment. So try to recall that and bring your queries tomorrow. Then they will give an overview on it. OMB will give an overview on zero-based budgeting. There was some intent language that said they should try to do that for a department or something like that, and they'll describe that effort. With that, we'll adjourn this meeting at 2:59. Thank you.